Today is Sunday, December 4th. The time is 3 p.m. My name is John Klass, and I'm interviewing the HIV activist Cornelius Wilson. We are currently in the Rehabilitation Institute of Michigan in Detroit, Michigan. Hello, Mr. Wilson.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. Cornelius Wilson has over 20 years' experience working in the field of human services. His career has focused on helping people with substance abuse issues or health concerns who are at risk of slipping through the cracks of the system. He has held the position as founder and executive director for a local HIV/AIDS advocacy and service organization, Men of Color Motivational Group, served as project director with Travelers Aid Society of Detroit, a premier case management and supportive housing agency, is senior case manager with Target Population Services, TAPS, Inc., for persons in recovery seeking recovery support services, and as the program director for Guiding Light Sober Living, Inc., an agency established to provide for the special needs of housing and recovery management. He is currently the co-chair of the Older Adult Summit and board treasurer for Sage Metro Detroit. Welcome. I would like to ask about some biographical information.
Sure.
Can I ask where you were born?
I was born here in Detroit. Just east of here. Grew up in this area. Had relatives that stayed in the Brewster Projects. We lived just east of here, just across the tracks. Attended Campbell Elementary, Newton Junior High, Northeastern High School. Graduated in 1975.
Were those DPS?
Yes.
Oh. Nice. So, what year were you born? Did you say?
I was born in 1957.
1957.
Yeah.
Okay.
February 5th.
February 5th. Great. And right here in Detroit. Did you have any thoughts about public service when you were young?
No, not really. As a kid, I had always thought about having my own business.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't quite sure what kind of business that would be, but I know that I wanted to be my own boss, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
My dad worked in the factory for years. My mom was a stay-at-home mom for a long time, and then when she did go to work, she was a home care worker, you know, housekeeper.
Sure.
Type person. And I didn't feel bad about that or anything. I just, you know, it didn't appear to provide a lot. Dad's job afforded us a middle class family type lifestyle, if you will. But Dad was also a heavy drinker, alcoholic. So that there were good times and there were bad times.
Yeah.
So that's where I am on that. Mom was the backbone, my best friend, supported me in everything and anything that I wanted to do. So without her, I probably would not have done a lot of what I did. Because she encouraged me to do and be whatever I thought I could.
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you have any other role models growing up? Or anyone who, ran their own business that you looked at?
My brothers-in-law. I have older sisters and their husbands. And their husbands seem to have, even though they worked at the plant as well, they seemed to have side businesses that worked real well for them. My oldest sister's husband's side business appeared to be selling insurance, and that worked real well for him. The other sister's husband, his side business was tearing down houses. And that seemed to put extra money in their pocket. And it appeared to afford them a lifestyle that appeared to be one step beyond where we were. And I think in large part because my dad was a heavy drinker. Whatever he didn't bring home, he drank up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he didn't have a side business?
No, not at all.
What got you thinking about advocacy work?
When I left college, one of the first corporate jobs I got was in a hospital setting. I was working in the kitchen, dietary, as a supervisor, over the purchasing and arranging of the kitchen storage areas, that kind of thing. And being there for, I think I was there for maybe a year, if that long, the politics, if you will, didn't sit very well with me. You know, there were things that would happen where management would encourage us to speak up about changes that we wanted to see as staff and what have you. And I used to listen to my coworkers complain about a lot of different things. And then when there was an opportunity for us to speak up, they wouldn't say anything. And I would be one of those few people that would speak up. So because nobody would speak up to back me up, it would appear to management that, like, I was the only one that had issues.
Oh, right.
And it It wasn't that I had any issues. It was that some of the changes that folks wanted to hear about or wanted to see done or implemented, they appeared to me to be scared to death of losing their job if they voiced that. But management consistently said, we encourage you to let us know, we want to make things better, da-da-da-da-da-da. And it wasn't so much management I got discouraged with. I got discouraged with my coworkers.
What kind of issues did they bring up, or did they want you to bring up for them, I guess?
There were issues that revolved around pay. There were issues that revolved around time off. There were issues that revolved around the operational areas. Because, you know, working in the kitchen, you know, it's a whole team of cooks.
Transportation needs assistance to 321-2. Transportation needs assistance to 321-2.
So, you know, there were a lot of little things like that. And management encouraged us, let us know as you work in these areas, let us know what things you identify that we can do, that we can implement to help make your job easier. One of the things that I did, I rearranged the storage area and the purchasing area that made things flow
priority
a lot smoother.
One, 347, priority one, 347.
Okay.
It don't normally even come that often. But I guess sometimes...
Just lucky, I guess, huh?
Right. So, you know...
So you were telling me about one of the things that you were changing with the...
Yeah, the change was the storage area.
Yeah.
To make things flow smooth. When we got in new shipment, how to rotate the stock so that we use the old stock up.
Oh, yeah.
And bring the new stock in, and how we store it in such a way so that you're not using the new stock right away. That you're storing it in such a way so that you're bringing the old stock to the front, the new stock in the back, that kind of thing. Throughout the refrigerators, the dry storage area, what have you. That worked very well for me. The hospital won a couple of awards for the changes that we made and that, things of that nature. So I felt kind of emboldened to be able to speak up on behalf of my coworkers, and they sort of encouraged me. I think the other part of it was they felt like, well, if he get fired, he get fired.
Right.
You know, but if he don't and they make some changes to our benefit, then we all benefit.
Yeah.
You know, and there were some little things that, that they did do, but it just seems like after a while, I got real discouraged and real frustrated with the fact that folks in our staff meetings would bitch and complain vehemently mm-hmm. about different things. But then when we had a chance to sit down and talk with management, nobody would say anything about anything except me. Mm-hmm. And then we went through a management change that appeared to the new management like I was the only one that was presenting these issues. Like I was encouraging other folks to go along with some of these changes.
Were there repercussions on you then?
No, I mean, you know, they there were, but there were not, they were not severe. Like I said, it got to the point to where it appeared as though I was the one that had the issue. Mm-hmm. And I was the one leading the pack. Because when we had an opportunity to meet with management, mostly everybody else kept their mouth shut. You know?
Yeah.
So my speaking up.
I'm going to be beeping at 344 and I'd be beeping at 344.
My way of speaking up forcefully, but not viciously. Asking for things without demanding. Mm-hmm. I was warned on a couple of occasions to watch my tone, that kind of thing. And I'm like, well, I'm speaking up on behalf of everybody. It's like, well, whenever we get everybody in the room, nobody speaks up but you. You, maybe one other. So, you know, if everybody's not on board, everybody's not on board. So, and a lot of those people end up leaving. They end up quitting, or either they end up getting fired for not doing an effective job. Hmm. I got fed up to the point, I don't remember exactly what happened. I quit. You know, I said I thought this corporate arena type work was what I wanted. And I quit. When I quit, I asked to be put back into the pool where they called me when they needed me. Of course, they called me more often than I wanted to be called because they knew the work that I had been doing.
Like temping?
Yes.
Okay.
And I live right behind the facility, so.
Was it more the coworkers who failed to stand with you, or was it the management that didn't listen?
The coworkers.
Yeah.
Because I believe if the coworkers had stood with me, management consistently said, let us know what it is you need to make the job much more comfortable. And I felt that it was one of them situations that folks were afraid of how far their success could take them. And I'm looking at the fact that this is a stepping stone for me. Mm-hmm. And as I do better, others will do better, and we can all do better, you know.
Well, it sounds like you had a negative reaction to advocacy there, because basically it sounds like you were describing that other people were letting you take the risk to
right.
represent their issues.
Exactly.
And they would stand to benefit if you were successful, and if you were unsuccessful, then
exactly.
you take all the blame. So
exactly.
So what made you want to keep going with advocacy work if that was your first experience?
Well, when I left there, when I quit that job, in the interim, I took a part-time job in the building where I live, and there were some people moving in, and they were putting together the first African-American AIDS service organization. And the job that I took in my building, I was working at the front desk, making sure that guests that came in and out of the building sign in and sign out, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. sort of a security monitor position. And after a little while, I got to meet the people because they would see me sitting there. And I would ask them about what they were doing, and they started telling me. And they told me that they were opening up an organization to address the HIV and AIDS issue. Mm. Now, I had heard about it at that time, but I didn't know a lot about what that was all about. And I thought that was interesting, because at that time, it was still viewed as a gay white male disease. So I hadn't heard about anybody in the black community actually dealing with it. And when they told me they were opening up this organization, that kind of piqued my interest. So one of the first things that they suggested that I could do, just to kind of initially get involved, on a, they did a support group one night out of the week for the people that came from treatment centers or wherever it was they were staying to the facility. They did the support group, and they would have experts come in and discuss certain topics. We as community volunteers were able to come down and help serve the food because we provided a dinner. So I decided to go down and do that. And in doing so, I sat and listened to some of these experts, begin to ask questions or what have you. And slowly but surely, it piqued my interest just to get involved because I began to learn how much that disease was affecting the Black community, unbeknownst to or unacknowledged by us. And it just kind of piqued my interest. So I continued going. As the organization became more solidified and they began to receive some funding from the state, they offered me a position as a counselor two nights a week, Mondays and Wednesdays. And I would come in at like 5 o'clock in the evening and provide HIV 101 counseling to folks that chose to come in and get tested between 5 and 9 p.m.
What was the name of this organization?
Community Health Awareness Group.
Okay.
Or CHAG for short. Started doing that. It went from that little peacetime to part-time, which was like 15 to 20 hours a week, to eventually full-time, okay? While I was working there full-time, I began to meet more and more Black men, more and more Black men like myself, and I even tested and found out about myself while I was there. Once I found out about myself, then I definitely knew I needed to learn more because I figured that I was not sleeping around in the way that it appeared that a lot of people acknowledged that they were when I sat in on the support groups and what have you. So I needed to learn more about, well, some of us are encountering this thing in a more casual way, and if this thing is primarily transmitted through sexual contact and intravenous drug use, I need to kind of determine what the hell did I do.
Yeah. So just to be clear, you're saying you tested positive for HIV?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was in 1987. Right. From there, I dove headlong into any and every workshop, seminar, conference. We had a program there at the agency where one or 2 days of the week, we would come over to the medical center and work with Dr. Lawrence Crane. As he identified folks that were positive, we were there to do the one-on-one counseling with them so that they wouldn't feel so ostracized and so that they had folks that looked like them, giving them some explanation, something to look forward to. And of course, you know, in those early days, there's very little medication, and people were dying shortly after diagnosis because folks were diagnosed when at the time they were being diagnosed, probably had been living with it for some time.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, I had been there, became full-time. And I found that to be, in doing that kind of counseling work, I found it to be very, very satisfying. Mm-hmm. You know, and I found that there were a lot of men, straight and or gay, or what have you, that opened up about their sexual lifestyles because they wanted to know more about how they could survive this issue. You know,
yeah.
There were a number of men that did not identify as gay or bisexual, but did admit to having relationships with men that were coming in and testing with their girlfriends. They were testing positive and the girlfriends weren't. And that just literally freaked them out. And it, I don't know if the girlfriends eventually knew or how things went.
Yeah, I'm sure that caused some relationship issues,
yes,
too.
Yes, really.
I have an ID beeping at 338. An ID is beeping at 338.
One of the key situations was when Magic Johnson came out about
his
HIV. Oh,
yeah, I remember. Yeah.
When he came out about his situation, our place was slammed. A lot of people showed up. Mm-hmm. Mostly, it was women bringing boyfriends, husbands, sons in to be tested. They were testing themselves, but they were bringing the husbands and sons and what have you in to be tested as well. In that is where I learned that there was more male-on-male sex amongst men who did not identify as gay, bisexual, none of those categories. Hmm. They were either married, in relationships with women, but they had these side relationships.
Oh, they just kept quiet about it?
Kept quiet about it. And in doing counseling with a number of these individuals, for whatever reason, they felt comfortable enough with me to share that aspect of their lifestyle. Of course, I kept it between me and them. But there were situational stories that folks shared that I'm like, I was totally taken aback. It's like, well, the heck have you made it so far? And this is all you're dealing with, you know? But obviously it was something that was out there. But like I say, one of the most attracting things to me was the fact that I was providing counseling. Based on the information I was gaining from the conferences and the workshops and the folks that I was dealing with on the professional expert level, I was sharing that with folks that I was meeting and dealing with through my counseling. And they felt comfortable enough to share with me, so I would share with them what I thought they could do to live a better quality of life. I became aware of resources in the community and how to direct folks towards those resources in a very discreet manner, by touching base from person to person, as opposed to giving them a list of things and having them go and, you know, I need help with this or I need help with that. And sometimes people, when you go to agencies, can be very probing to determine if you're eligible for resources. My thing was to make contact with someone at an agency because they knew what we did and they knew the population we dealt with, and make sure that the person I made contact with was going to be the person that the client was going to be dealing with that I sent to their agency. And they would have told me in our phone conversation if the person was eligible for what we were sending them for.
Oh, okay.
That way the client didn't feel like they were getting a runaround.
Right.
Or they didn't feel like they were going and giving their personal business to every other Tom, Dick, Harry, and Sue.
Yeah.
And not getting anything out of it to help them.
Yeah, they're trying to keep it quiet, right?
Exactly.
They don't want to go and talk to every hospital administrator along the way.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good.
Exactly. So that's where I learned, and that was my interest. You know, and I decided that was going to be my career path wherever it took me. While I was there, my director at the time felt that there was a need for a support group for African-American men. Mm-hmm. And he brought in a young man to work with us who had a bachelor's degree in social work. And he brought him in to develop this support group.
Was this the Men of Color Motivational Group?
Exactly. Okay. Well, that's what it eventually became.
Oh.
Initially, the support group, we didn't have I don't remember what the name was, if we had a name at all.
Transportation needs assistance in 340. Ruben and Crystal, transportation needs assistance in 340. mower Diane to the front desk.
Can we shut that speaker off?
I don't know if there's a way to shut it off.
That's what editing's for.
Okay.
So yeah, you were talking about those early years with.
He came in. His name was Howard. Mm-hmm. He came in to help develop this program. The initial thought was that we wanted to do it away from the agency. And we went around and handed out flyers, went to the areas, you know, Palmer Park, areas where the population we thought hung out, that we thought would come. And for whatever reason, they weren't responding. People just was not responding. So he got discouraged after a while, and he moved on to do something else. I chose to stay, and I started mentioning it by word of mouth to a number of friends and associates that I dealt with outside of that organization. And I let them know what I was doing. And when I went out to the club, because I was still partying, mm-hmm. I would mention to some degree what I was doing. Slowly but surely, some of my friends and old buddies started coming, bringing their buddies in to be tested. And I told them that we were doing this meeting for brothers like us, just for us. It was confidential. And we did it on a Tuesday night. And
where did you meet?
At the agency, at CHAG agency. Mm. And we met from 6 to 9. Mm-hmm. And we provided a light meal. We started out by potlucking because we didn't have money to do the meal. And a lot of the guys that came, they got into it. And I would identify speakers to come in to talk to us about not only living with HIV, but about other things, other resources in the community. Other social services available in the community. And we came in to talk about dealing with our lifestyles, that being different from the majority of our families. And that seemed to catch on like wildfire. And folks started showing up, bringing friends, bringing buddies. And as they brought friends and buddies while they were there, we had the nurse stick around so that anybody that wanted to be tested could be tested.
Oh, wow. Great.
And
Ms. Green, please put a light on. Ms. Green, put a light on.
And for those that came, I'll let them know that if you're tested, you can always come back and get your result from me.
Okay.
And I would maintain your tests confidentially. And I think that was kind of comforting to a lot of guys because they didn't feel like they had to come back and talk to a stranger or some female that they didn't know or hadn't seen before. And that kind of, once again, it opened up the floodgates. You know, so many guys started showing up that we literally couldn't meet there anymore. And we had a relationship with the church, St. Matthew, St. Joseph. And the director and myself, we approached them about having our meetings there because they have a big meeting room in the hotel basement. And so we started a meeting down at the hotel basement. There were a group of young men that were coming to the meetings that felt that we needed to have our own organization.
After now, chef, please pick up your Cisco phones.
Aside from CHAG, that we needed to have something that addressed our issues and what have you. But once again, there was no one willing to step up and take the lead. So I volunteered to take the lead.
And that's how you became the founder of the Men of Color Motivational Group?
Exactly.
So did you end up, did you say that you were in a church basement or in a...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we were meeting in a church basement. We were there for almost 2, maybe 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the church basement, the capacity of the church basement was 200 people sitting.
Mm-hmm.
There were Tuesdays when we were over capacity to the point that every seat was full and there were folks lining up around the walls.
Did the church know what your meetings were for? Was there any friction? Because I know with some churches there might have been.
Father Harmon, Pastor Harmon, was the pastor of the church at the time, and he was in 100% support of what we were doing. Mm-hmm. I think he eventually came out to us about his lifestyle. Of course, we didn't know that. But he was in 100% support of what we were doing. And when he saw the attendance, you know, and even him, he agreed to participate in some of our discussions because we opened our discussions up to homosexuality in the church, where we had a panel discussion where we brought in pastors from different churches that a lot of our community attended, the Catholic Church, whatever.
Wow.
And we did a panel discussion with them. We brought in doctors. We brought in social workers. We did panel discussions with our family members. Of how to deal with finding out that your loved one happens to be gay.
Uh-huh.
We brought in veterans to talk about, because there were a number of guys that were veterans and had served in the armed forces who were also gay or bisexual. Mm-hmm. So we did panel discussions with individuals who had been in the armed forces and had literally served their time in the armed forces, unbeknownst to a few of their lifestyle, you know, but now they're also dealing with the HIV. Also, we talked about the black and white men together, for lack of a better term, phenomenon. There were several other organizations out there that were forming in the community to address some of these issues. Black and white men together.
What do you mean by that one specifically? Black and white men together. Interracial dating?
Interracial dating.
Okay.
Exactly. Because there
was that controversial still in 1987?
1987, now we're talking the early 90s, and there was some controversy. It was more common in the African-American community for a gay black man to be with a gay white man than it to be known two black gay men together.
Really?
At that time.
Why is that?
I think there was some sense of safety in getting with a gay white male, because in that way you sort of transferred from your community to a different community, where things appeared to be, not always, but appeared to be more comfortable. You could be yourself with your partner, okay? But as time went on and more organizations around the country began to form like Men of Color, more African-American men came out. More African-American men became comfortable in talking about their lifestyles, and more African-American men became more prominent in talking about their relationships amongst ourselves, like myself. I've never dated a white male. You know, I've had friends in the community, but that was something, it wasn't, I don't want to say taboo, that was frightening to me, because that was something that I never did. And I didn't know how that would go. Never had any kind of intimate relationship with a white person like that. You know, so it's like, I don't even see how y'all do that. But there were guys that did it. And they appeared to have some sense of comfort in who they are being with them. But like I say, as time went on and we became more out, we became more comfortable in who we are as we are. Mm-hmm. And we began to assert ourselves in the community, not in an overly aggressive way. After our Tuesday night meetings, we would go to dinner somewhere in the community at a restaurant. and we would take over the restaurant. And the restaurant, of course, because they were making money, well, one thing, but the restaurant would welcome us with open arms. And we would go to a different restaurant every Tuesday. And the restaurants we went to, people were just taken aback.
Yeah.
Tanisa, can you signal?
By all of these black men who were not stereotypically gay, hanging out together, you know. And so we began to exert our education, entrepreneurship, love of other black men, love of family, love of community. And as we begin to assert that, people begin to acknowledge that, okay, well, I know you've always done this, and I know you've always been in the community doing that, but I didn't know this aspect of you. And it all it did was kind of reassure folks that there was no difference in the gay person and the person you knew before I came out. You know, with my family, with my fear was how my family would treat me. First of all, my mom. Mm-hmm. Once I told my mom what I was dealing with, first the HIV, she was very comforting in that. Her thing was, well, I knew something was going on. That's why you're working in this field. I was like, well, that ain't why I'm working in this field. But working in this field is giving me a way to deal with this.
Yeah.
So she sort of understood that. And then when I told her about mine being gay, her thing was...
How old were you? I'm sorry, when you did that.
That would have been around 1989,
1990. Okay.
I can't tell you the age, but... 1990,
but you were grown out of the house. It sounded like,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Living on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But me and my mom have always been like really, really tight.
Mm-hmm.
But I was fearful because, you know, as a kid, you grow up, you hear things, people say things. My brothers, my younger brother, my older brother, they used to say stuff. I don't want no sissy in the family and da 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 da. But that's because of their limited knowledge of what they thought gay people were all about. When my mother told me she was okay with it, I could care less than a damn what anybody else thought. And that was my empowerment, if you will, to be more of who I was. And like I told her, I've never been the kind of gay man that desired to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Never, ever, 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 ever. That just, I know there's some people out there that feel they are one sex trapped in a different sex body,
right?
Gender-wise. That's not me. I just happen to be a man who's attracted to men.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been attracted to sissies, if you will, a very effeminate gay man.
Okay.
I've never been attracted to, trans men, you know.
Right.
I met trans men who were born female and transitioned to men, who are having to be very, very attractive. But just in knowing that there was something that...
Not for you?
Not for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
So were some of these things that... concerns that your mother had, or things that you thought your mother might be concerned about, that she would have a stereotype about you?
I think there was a stereotype that there still is a stereotype in the community for those that choose to remain ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
That gayness represented a weakness. Gayness represented a alien nations. You know, it's like, where did that come from? You know, but as I came out and was more comfortable in who I was, my mother opened up to me about other family members. Because she come from a very large family in the South that were the same way. Mm-hmm. But it was never talked about.
Right.
Okay. And I began to learn of other family members and other folks closely affiliated with the family that was gay, lesbian, maybe even bisexual. That it just wasn't talked about. And that's why I was saying earlier that a lot of the work that I've done over the years was in part directly related to my growth and development as a person. Because I got involved, you know, Men of Color end up being the organization to address issues for Black gay men. That was not my sole mission. My mission for Men of Color was to address issues for the Black man in the community. Because to me, it did not appear that Black men were utilizing healthcare resources, human services resources, child rearing resources, things of that nature. Not to the exclusion of women, but with the focus on right. men and men of color,
sure.
And not just Black men, because there were a number of Hispanic Latino men that got involved. There were a number of guys that were here from the Caribbean, mm-hmm. that Afro-Caribbean, I guess you could say, and then there were a number of white guys that were involved with the organization that didn't identify as gay, but I believe they were bisexual, but they considered themselves allies, you know, and they were very empathetic to the cause.
Great. So it sounds like I got you thinking about healthcare concerns. Your next, the next job I wanted to ask you about was the DHWP-B SAPDR, or in English, the Detroit Department of Health and Wellness Promotion and the Bureau of Substance Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery.
Right.
I had a fun time researching these. So that job you started in 2003. Your job was to help develop and coordinate recovery support services and housing for individuals and
right.
families recovering from alcohol and other substances.
Right.
How did you move to this job, and what were the connections from your previous position with Men of Color? What did you learn along the way?
When I left Men of Color in 2000, I took some time off. The reason I left Men of Color was because there was some political stuff. You know, that was all new to me, mm-hmm. the nonprofit world.
Mm-hmm.
We happen to be the largest organization of our type. We was getting support from a number of major entities. And then there came these individuals who thought that their education and everything put them in a better position to run the organization than me. Even though I had got it going from the ground up, I had secured a number of the funding, I had learned how to deal with a lot of this stuff, and had things working well, mm-hmm. I thought. But then we had these very radical brothers that came along that felt like, we got all these white agencies throwing all this money at us, and we don't have this, and this in place to handle it. And my thing was, well, as they're giving us the money, let's identify what we need and put it in place,
mm-hmm.
rather than be offensive to them and tell them to stop. Well, that went on for some time. We went through the point of trying to get people on the board of directors that would be supportive, and the board fractured.
Mm.
There were those that were supporting me and what I had been doing all along, and there were those that felt like, oh, we need to be going in a different direction.
Right.
And I just got fed up with that. When I got fed up with it, I decided to let it go. I stepped away from it. when I left there, I took some time off to reevaluate what I wanted to do. I knew I really enjoyed this work. So in the interim, I took about 2-3 months off work, and I started working with Travelers Aid Society. Mm. One of the directors there was familiar with me and the work I had been doing with men of color. He approached me and asked me to work with Travelers Aid. He hired me in as a senior case manager, which was a supervisory position. And we worked with, they provided case management with low-income housing for individuals that were completing treatment and or living with HIV. And because I had been dealing with that population, they felt that I would be a good fit for a program they had just written a grant for and had secured Shelter Plus Care grant. And that Shelter Plus Care grant provided monies for us to do low-income housing for individuals that qualify and to provide ongoing supportive services. I did that for a couple of years, and we had a partnership with Health Services Technical Assistance, which was the substance abuse assessment arm of the Bureau of Substance Abuse.
Oh, okay.
The partnership we had with them was that any of the people that we dealt with at Travelers Aid that had a substance abuse or a recovery issue, we referred to them to be sent for outpatient NAAA meeting to be assessed for supportive services and around substance abuse. Eventually, Travelers Aid ran out. And I approached Mr. Richardson at HSTA, Health Services Technical Assistance, ATS, whatever that stood for. They were under the umbrella of the Bureau of Substance Abuse.
Okay.
They did the assessments and referrals for substance abuse treatment for the city of Detroit, county of Wayne, and I think it was Wayne. And I think some out counties. But anyway, when I approached Mr. Richardson, at first he didn't think there was anything he had for me. Then he remembered that he had a residual grant left over from working with Travelers Aid that had not been used to provide some case management and services. So I started working with him, doing the same thing I had been doing when I was at CHAG, providing some counseling. But as individuals were going into treatment, we started doing supportive services, job referrals, housing referrals, that kind of thing for folks that were in treatment to help them transition from treatment into society on a continuum basis so that hopefully they didn't fall through the cracks.
Is that like halfway houses, kind of?
Well, some of them may have been in halfway houses, but the housing we were looking at, they may have went in halfway houses temporarily, but I eventually made a connection with the state and the Homeless Action Network of Detroit. And they are the coordinating arm for the County of Wayne, City of Detroit, County of Wayne Continuum of Care, which was providing how to end homelessness. And they also provide the monies to the various programs that do low-income housing type programs. In doing that, there came a time where Section 8 waiting lists opened up through them. And because I had established that relationship with them, as I was processing folks that were completing treatment and or had completed treatment and were in transitional housing and had some sort of income, then I was able to do the application with them for Section 8 housing. Nice. That moved them into them having their own place.
So this was all from 2003 to 2012?
Right.
That was what you're doing there?
Right.
So then from 2006 to 2010, you were a program manager at Guiding Light.
Right, that was the second job.
That was the
so along with the Bureau of Substance Abuse.
Oh, okay.
It was under that umbrella.
So yeah, it looked like your work at the Guiding Light Sober Living Foundation for Men overlapped with your job at the health department a little
exactly.
bit, but I see you've explained that pretty well.
Yeah, at the health department, I became the recovery management coordinator for for the Bureau of Substance Abuse.
Oh, okay.
And the director of the health department at that time wanted a transitional housing program focused on men that were at high risk for contracting or living with HIV. And it was a substance abuse-based program where they would be able to live on site, get the substance abuse treatment, and hopefully transition from being in treatment to doing outpatient to being in their own home. And that's where Guiding Light came in.
Right.
And I partnered with a gentleman that was doing it already to some degree for women. So I approached him because I didn't want to go back into doing another organization by myself and going through all that again. But that ended up turning out just as bad because he was a very poor business manager.
Uh-oh.
So even though the health department was paying us as they promised to pay us for the program, he wasn't paying our vendors and he wasn't paying the guy that was giving us the apartment building where we were doing the program.
Yeah.
And I stuck with that for about 2 years till I got fed up with that, you know, and I moved on from that. But I was still with the Bureau of Substance Abuse as the recovery management coordinator. So as the recovery management coordinator, I went around to all of the substance abuse agencies that the Bureau, under the umbrella of the Bureau, to make sure that some of the things that were recovery, we implemented what we call a recovery-oriented system of care versus a acute care model. You know, in other words, for folks who were in treatment, we want to assess what led to you being in treatment, what led to you using drugs,
right?
What led to you being in this treatment facility, and what is it that we can do to support you as you begin to move from this facility. And what is it that you think will help keep you on the straight and narrow? And let's try and put those things in place. In other words, meeting the client where they are.
Yeah.
As opposed to imposing, you need to do this, and you need to do 10 NA meetings, and you need to do 50 push-ups.
Some kind of standard boilerplate.
You know, in other words, individualized treatment planning.
Yeah.
And basically finding out from each individual, what do you think works for you?
Mm-hmm.
And let's make sure that we're doing what it is that you says will help you. Now, we can make suggestions to modify or to help that, or you can make suggestions as we go to implement things, or if it seems to be too much,
sure.
If it seems to be too little, whatever the case may be.
Great.
So I was in charge of that.
Yeah. So now I'd like to ask you about... there were a bunch of organizations. I'm just going to kind of run through them all quickly because I don't, you know, we're running short on time here, but I do want to get your comments. Let's see. In 2009, you were co-chair of SEMHAC, Southeast Michigan HIV/AIDS Council. In 2011, you were chairman for the annual gathering conference for LGBT issues that organized Hotter Than July, Detroit's LGBT Black Pride. And in 2011, was the Older Adult Coalition.
Right.
Here you were co-chair. And then in 2015, it looks like this organization became a regional chapter for a national organization called SAGE.
Exactly.
Services and Advocacy for GLBT, Elders in Detroit. And
right.
Then in 2012, you became treasurer and board member for Gay Elders of Detroit. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different organizations.
Gay Elders of Detroit is SAGE.
Okay.
We started out as Gay Elders of Southeast Michigan, trying to form the SAGE.
Oh.
But there were board members that drug the process out.
Mm.
Out. Just drug it out.
Yeah.
We got a lot of good things in place, but for whatever reason, it got to the point of where we got stuck.
Okay.
We were a part of the Older Adult Coalition. The Older Adult Coalition was an organization that brought straight, gay, were primarily service organizations that services the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
to the table to talk to them about how they are dealing with the issues of older folks who may be gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender. And if they had policies in place to deal with elder abuse. Mm.
Tess, you have a call at the desk. Tess, you have a call at the desk.
And those type of issues.
Okay.
And we eventually ended up identifying a couple of new board members that came on board, and they were able to kind of take it and move it that one last step forward to become a SAGE chapter.
Well, what's the value in that, in becoming a SAGE chapter?
The value in that is that we're a regional entity autonomously, but we're connected to the national SAGE, because SAGE is a national organization.
Yeah.
And having that national umbrella, it gives us the level of credibility to garner the resources and additional support that the organization needs to implement services in this general area for our senior group, senior peers. Because as it happens around the country, we know even though a lot of the issues are similar around the country, we know what the issues are in this particular area or region. So
what are the major issues what would you say right now in Detroit?
As it is across the board with poor people, period, but it's primarily transportation, mm-hmm. adequate housing, adequate food for a lot of LGBT older adults, isolation, because as they become older, they're not sure who they can trust with regards to knowing about their alternative lifestyle, the fear of being mistreated as an older adult in that respect.
I was looking at some research.
Mm-hmm.
CDC said there is an issue with this for elderly people, and the issue was stigma. They said that older people in the United States are more likely than younger people to be diagnosed with HIV infection late in the course of infection. They may have the same HIV risk factors as young people, but there's an added complication in the form of stigma,
right,
which is a particular concern among older people because they may already face isolation due to illness or loss of family and friends, so they delay treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the preliminary, if you will, symptoms associated with HIV may resemble something that they may already be dealing with. So if they are not aware that they've encountered HIV, and they're going to their primary doctor and the doctor isn't testing for it, then it can easily be overlooked.
Right, if they're just feeling some aches and pains.
Exactly. If they're going through mild, cold, or flu-like symptoms, and because they're older, you know, they may be going to the doctor, and the doctor may deem that, well, you know, someone at your age, this is not quite out of the ordinary.
Right.
Take a little bit of this, do a little bit less of that, and it should pass. Whereas, like you say, it could be definitively attached to being HIV positive.
Right.
Because there are a lot of older people that are still very sexually active, and they're not using protection.
Yeah. So one thing I definitely wanted to have you talk more about was the abuse that can happen in elder care facilities. In June 2016, your Pride Source article quoted you as saying, "A very real and common fear for LGBT older adults is the negative or hostile treatment they may receive in Michigan long-term care facilities or when the medical profession is treating them. Many LGBT older adults go back into the closet for fear of being harassed or even physically assaulted in spaces that they previously considered safe. I mean, this is horrific. How widespread is this problem? But what can we do? What do you do to address it?
Well, one of the things that we're doing at SAGE is that's what we're doing as far as getting with the elder care providers around the counties. As a matter of fact, I think we just secured a very large grant to expand our training, to do training of the staff of senior care provider programs, state elder care provider programs, just desensitization, awareness that LGBT people may be a part of your facility or what have you. But it's pretty broad because there are so many older people that may be LGBT, probably more LGB than T, that may choose to go back into the closet because from their perspective and the era that they came up in, that was a very negative thing to be known as lesbian, gay, even bisexual. Mm. So to be in a facility where you choose to be open about that and you're at the mercy of folks that are giving you your food, folks that are giving you medications, folks that are literally taking care of you, folks that you rely on to clean you depending on your medical situation. It's a horrifying feeling to think that if I share with somebody that I happen to be LGBT, and they start treating me differently, what the hell can I do?
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people feel like that. I don't feel like that because I'm the kind of person, I'm going to speak up. You know, if I feel you treat me differently, not just because of my sexual orientation, just if you treat me differently, I want to speak up. I'm going to speak up. I'm going to ask for a supervisor. I'm going to ask for somebody in charge, and your ass got to go, at least while I'm here. Now, what they do with you is up to them. But I recognize that there are a lot of people that don't have that same strength.
Yeah.
And their fear is understandable, particularly when you hear, as with this last election, when you hear a lot of fear-mongering, you know, even though it's targeted at other ethnic groups, minorities, what have you. There's still a lot of people that are not very happy with the fact that LGBT community just acquired marriage equality. There's still a lot of people that still think that just being around an LGBT person could lead to them catching AIDS. You know, there's still a lot of ignorance out there.
Yeah.
You know, and the fear mongering that comes through when you have a Donald Trump, if you will, just as an example, not him per se, but using language on the campaign trail that sparks fear of policy rollbacks.
So it's just kind of
changes,
raising the anxiety level for everybody.
Exactly. Across the board.
Yeah.
Which emboldens groups of people out there to make them think now it's okay to target and be discriminate towards other minorities, other groups of people.
Sure.
That it's okay to put down gay people, that it's okay to publicly attack Muslims, you know, stuff of that nature.
Right.
You know, and I don't think that's something that he encourages, but I think some of what came through on the campaign trail sort of, and then the fact that he won so overwhelmingly, to some of those small thinking people out there, basically to them that said, okay, our day has come.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it's a scary feeling. Sad.
Sad, scary, all that. But, you know, I think, you know, he recognizes that marriage equality, as he said, that was settled by the Supreme Court. He's not going to go back and try and overturn it. Not him himself. Now, his constituency, that may be a different issue that they may take up.
Yeah.
You know, because the they have the presidency, the House, and the Senate now. So,
yeah.
Now we have a complete Republican government.
I know. So, I think we're at time here, but before we go, is there anything else that I didn't ask you? Is there anything else that maybe an outsider who doesn't know about the issues of the elderly, the issues of LGBT, African-American communities, people in Detroit, anything specifically that you've worked on, anything that you want to let people know about that's important?
Well, I guess I would want people to be aware that I do a support group, if you will, for LGBT seniors mm-hmm. once a month at Hannon House. That's been turning out pretty good. This year was the last year that I said that I was going to chair the Older Adult Summit. The Older Adult Summit is an annual educational event that brings people from around the state together on elder issues. That's usually the third Saturday in June every year. This is probably going to be my last year chairing the annual gathering on LGBT issues. Which is the African-American Gay Pride, Hotter Than July.
Yeah, okay.
I was one of the co-founders of that as well. But, you know, that's African-American-specific LGBT issues, not exclusive to. It's an opportunity to build bridges,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to invite and encourage collaboration across communities. And just that we're all one community, you know, and the only way we're going to make it is as one community, you know. There are a lot of good ideas in our different areas, and there are various times that I think it's important that we come together and share those ideas and try to implement some things that can move us as a community forward. And because now I consider myself an elder, gay, black man, those issues, and I'm dealing with issues, you know, that are related to my age, you know, medically, some emotionally, that we have to be there to support one another. And we have to make sure that the entities that we have to deal with are sensitive to the fact that we exist and are using these services.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone feels as though they're being treated any differently, there has to be some accountability.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much where I am.
Okay. Well, Mr. Wilson, thank you so much. Yes, that was awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time for me today.
Sure, not a problem.
This interview. So I'll just shut it down now.